It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
You know, I saw this stat online that somebody sent me. After WrestleMania, when Roman and Seth lost their titles, it marked the first time since January of 2020 that no member of the Shield was a champion in any promotion. That lasted all of 5 days, because Jon Moxley defeated Tetsuya Naito at the New Japan Windy City Riot Show in Chicago Friday night to become the new IWGP World Heavyweight Champion, and in so doing, he becomes the first man in history to hold the WWE, AEW, and IWGP world titles. The moment that they announced Moxley against Naito a couple of months ago, I told you. I said I thought Moxley was going to leave as the champion. That was before they even made it official that the title would be on the line. I said he's going to win it, and then he's going to drop it to Shooter at Forbidden Door, his protege, Shota Umino. One of the young stars New Japan has been building for the future. The time is now. Time is now to elevate at least one of these guys to a top spot. They lost Okada. They lost Will Ospreay. Tanahashi can't be that guy anymore. You know, guys like Umino and Yota Tsuji, they're the future main eventers in that company. Who better to beat Moxley for that belt than the kid he took under his wing? Tsuji may be more ready than he is for that spot. I think either one of them, frankly, would be a good choice, but Moxley is not going to be a long-term champion. I can see it from both sides, though. Why people would love the move, why people would hate the move. You know, some may hate the move because it's yet another foreigner they put a title on. They did it with Matt Riddle, they did it with Nick Nemeth, now they did it with Jon Moxley. But if it puts over one of the young guys, I think that's fine. You know, Umino beat Jack Perry on the same show, the scapegoat, who walked out in Chicago wearing a jacket that said, "Cry me a river" on the back, mocking CM Punk with the GTS taunt during his match. He walked out with fake police and riot gear. I'll have more to say about old Jungle Boy a little bit later. This is episode 857 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, April 14th, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. I want to say thank you to our PayPal producers this week showing their support. You want to make a donation, you can always do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the link at the very top of the page. I want to say thank you to Chris the Captain Rowe. Thank you for the support. Please do introduce yourself the next time you make it to a hog show. Thank you, man. Big B Brian Becerra, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Final Boss Frederick McCullough, the Gentleman Masher, Shane Maniachi, Brian Man of the Hour, Musha, David Bulletproof Bentz, Night Stalker Nayef Al Safar, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, Killshot Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, who says that Mama Eichard says Jack Perry for life, cry me a river. You say that from Chicago. You gotta be careful. I mean, that'll get you shot over there. I mean, come on, I don't want to see anything happen to Mama Eichard here. But send her my love. And my condolences to Rick from South Carolina. His friend Bobby passed away unexpectedly on Monday. He said they used to listen to my Dark Side of the Ring reviews together all the time, and he is going to miss him very much. Rick, I am very sorry for your loss. Big E tweeted a health update yesterday, 2 years after he broke his neck on SmackDown, taking an overhead belly-to-belly on the floor from Ridge Holland, and he fractured his C1 and C6 vertebrae. It was scary, there's no doubt about that, but he has not wrestled a match since, and he tweeted the other day, 2 year neck scans are in, things are unchanged. My C1 has healed fibrously, but has not formed new bone. I am not medically cleared, and truthfully, I may never be cleared. But I am blessed to be free of pain, immensely happy, and otherwise healthy. Life is good. And that's really the most important thing. He is pain-free. He can train. He can do all the things he normally would do, as any regular person would do, and he's happy. You know, to me, it always sounded overly optimistic, given the nature of his injury, that he would ever be back in the ring. Yeah, it's like the Tyson Kidd thing. He's just lucky to be alive right now. And he has found another way to contribute to the business, helping others. So there are any number of things that Big E can be doing to stay involved if he wants to be. They used him as a panelist on the pre-shows before both nights of WrestleMania. He could do commentary. He could manage. I could see him as a general manager one day. It sucks that his career got cut short at 36. You know, he's 38 now. Multi-time tag team champion, intercontinental champion, Money in the Bank winner, WWE champion. I mean, it's not as if he didn't have success. I mean, just New Day alone. New Day alone still being a thing, and you see their body of work and all the merch they sold and how over they were for pretty much most of their run. That alone is a success story. But he needs to do what's best for his quality of life, and if he's happy, then there's no reason to risk that. You know, even if WWE was open to clearing him. So WrestleMania is in the rear view. Cody Rhodes finished his story. And he shut up a lot of people who still didn't think that he was a draw or he was a big enough name to be in that position. An internal memo went out to members of the WWE staff stating that between WWE World in Philly and WWE Shop, Cody Rhodes sold over $1 million in merchandise throughout WrestleMania weekend. I think they're going to do just fine with him as their new face. And good for him. The man earned it. This doesn't happen if he doesn't leave the company in 2016. He begged and pleaded for months for them to drop the Stardust gimmick, but Vince McMahon would not relent. He wanted him to keep it, and Cody knew it was a dead end for his career if he did. He'd probably still be in the makeup now. Even Triple H, when he learned that Cody was leaving, he took it personally. He was shocked. He couldn't believe that Cody wanted out after everything he had done for his dad. And it's like Cody told him, look, I appreciate you giving my father a job and everything, you know, everything you did for him, but I'm not him. And he's not here anymore. You know, he knew that he had to leave if he was ever going to have a chance to be in the position that he now finds himself in. Drew McIntyre, he got fired and he went out and he completely reinvented himself, came back a much bigger name than he was when he left. That's what you have to do sometimes. And it paid off in a big way for him last weekend. I know there were people who still thought Roman was retaining. Shockingly so to me that these people still existed. I thought it was pretty obvious that the time had come. Everything they did set up for Cody getting his big moment. Right? Roman Reigns, he made history with his 9th WrestleMania main event. He passed Hulk Hogan on the all-time list, which is a big deal. And you know, to me, that is more impressive than him moving into number 3 had he done so. You know, had they gone all the way to September and he would have moved into number 3 on the all-time list for the longest title reign, this is more important or more impressive to me than that. WrestleMania is their big annual event. Everything is built around that main event. And the fact that Roman Reigns has found himself there 9 times, even if those first few were forced, and they were, it's impressive that he already has 9 of them to his name. Hogan's last WrestleMania main event was in 1993. That was a few months before his 40th birthday. Roman turns 39 next month, and he still has a few more left in him. He's going to hit at least a dozen, I would say, before he's all said and done. Roman's run will go down in the history books, not so much for the quantity, the immense quantity of matches that he had because he wasn't around that much, but because he was the champion during one of the company's most lucrative periods. They did big business with him as the champion and with that bloodline story. Roman Reigns was not the only reason why WWE is making billions and billions of dollars, but that bloodline story that he was the centerpiece of had a lot to do with that company's success and a lot of their rating success. And the majority of matches that he did have were all excellent. Now, both matches with Cody were excellent. I would go 5 stars on this last one. I know some people were freaking out that Meltzer shaved off 1/4 of a star and didn't go the full 5, but who cares? I don't know why we have to go through this every single time. Who gives a shit? It's the man's opinion. It was a 5-star match to me. It had everything I wanted out of it. It had good action, the right people getting involved since it was bloodline rules and they all but told you there was going to be a ton of interference. It had emotion. It had the happy ending. And, you know, the callback to WrestleMania 10 with the new champion being hoisted up on the shoulders of the babyfaces and the ushering in of a new era, which they kept drilling into our heads the entire weekend that this was the official kickoff of the Paul Levesque era. They made that very clear. Cody revealed he signed a new contract recently. It's going to take him past his 40th birthday. He's 38 now. And that's important because Cody had previously said that he wanted to step away from the ring when he turned 40. And after I was done laughing, even I knew that was not going to happen. If I had a dollar for every wrestler I have heard say something similar, oh, I'm going to retire when I'm 40. I'm going to retire when I'm 50. I'd probably have about $100 in my pocket. I remember years ago hearing Booker T say the same thing. He wanted to be done by the time he was 40. Guys take better care of themselves today, unless you're Darby Allin. But they do. You know, they take better care of themselves. They're better athletes. They make good money well into their 40s. It's hard to give that up. When you have guaranteed money, if you're even close to being a top name or an upper, you know, kind of an upper tier name in WWE, or, you know, Tony Khan is paying you in AEW, you're probably making pretty good fucking money. Why would you give that up? If you feel physically that you can still go another 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, you think people are just going to up and walk away from that? Cody, you know, he finally achieved what he always wanted. He did it later in life than he probably wanted to. He would have liked to have been in this position at 34, not 38. But finally, the company has anointed him its top babyface. There was no way he was stepping away from all that at 40 years old. And I'll tell you something else. Whenever this new contract ends, he'll sign at least one more. Even if it's with a Roman Reigns type of schedule. He will sign one more at least. Because if he is still making great money and he is still selling merch and he is positioned at the top of the card, even if he's not the champion, there is nobody, not one person, on that roster right now, or any roster, who would be willing to give all that up and walk away. The only change I would have made to that main event last Sunday, I nearly predicted it right down to each run-in. Remember what I said? I said Jay is going to come out and counter Jimmy, and then John Cena is going to come out and take care of Solo, and then it would fall on Stone Cold Steve Austin to come out and take out The Rock with a Stone Cold Stunner. If there was a roof on Lincoln Financial Field, it would have been blown off. 25 years after Rock and Austin met at WrestleMania for the first time in Philadelphia. How appropriate. Stone Cold and The Rock, look, they shared a ring together 10 years ago in New Orleans to open WrestleMania 30. So I was hoping, hey, here we are, WrestleMania 40, 10 years later. We need that Stone Cold cameo at WrestleMania 40. And we didn't get it. Instead, we got The Undertaker chokeslamming The Rock. Not even really The Undertaker, I mean... It was just out there in a hoodie. It was Mark Calloway chokeslamming The Rock. I think a lot of people were expecting the glass to shatter. So the gong going off for the big surprise pop, it still worked. It was still a big moment. But that would have been a reaction for the ages had Austin come out. I was bummed that he didn't. I did see the report from Dave Meltzer. The reason that we didn't see Stone Cold, according to him, boils down to money. He said Austin was the person originally earmarked for that spot, but in the end, they couldn't reach a financial agreement, and Undertaker was the backup. Now, that's what Meltzer is reporting. I know, you know, Austin texted Kevin, according to Nash, Austin texted with Kevin Nash, they're good friends. He texted Nash during the show to ask him, hey, are you in Philadelphia? And Nash told him, nope. And Austin said, we must be the only two not there. It could just very well be that Austin just didn't want to do it. He didn't want to be bothered. He didn't want to go. Maybe he wanted Cody to have his moment and not overshadow it. It could be any number of things. But that would be a bummer if money was the only reason. But like I said, it didn't ruin my enjoyment of the match. It was just a big missed opportunity to get Austin and heel Rock back in the ring together one last time. Because when are we going to get to see that again, right? Probably never. For Raw and SmackDown this week, they used the smaller staging and not the giant LED set they usually do to fit in as many people into the buildings as they could. According to PW Insider, this setup is going to be the norm going forward, at least for the shows with high ticket demand. The set they used for SmackDown was a little bit different than the one they used for Raw, but it was still smaller. I love it. I'm in total support of this move. So long as the product stays hot and they can sell those tickets, why not? I mean, we're talking about, just by doing what they did, apparently they put anywhere from 4,000 to 5,000 people more into the buildings. The demand right now is ridiculous. And so, you know, Endeavor and WWE, they look at this and they go, shit, what are we doing here? You know, we're closing off a quarter of the building here. Let's put as many people in here as we possibly can. It's not always going to be like this. So pack them in while you can. Now, having a Tron of some kind is needed today because of all the backstage segments they show. And I know they usually have screens above the ring in most arenas, but if they want to have at least one screen as part of the set, and you look at the set they used on Friday, which is very long, you could still use those screens. But if you want to have like a proper screen, I do have a suggestion. There was a setup that WWE used around 1992 into 93, where the guys would walk out, not straight, but like from an angle. They would walk out, because that's where the entranceway was positioned. Again, it wasn't dead on. It was kind of off to the side. And they would walk out, and to their right, as the guys would be walking out, you would see this smaller screen. And they would usually show their logo on it, because every wrestler had their own logo back then. I think that setup would work really well, too. They also used to have this giant WWF logo to the left when they would walk out. So that was the first thing you saw. They could do the same thing here, create this giant WWE logo, have it standing there to their left as they walk out, and you have the smaller screen that sort of sits on the ground. It wouldn't take up, you know, that much space. At least you'd have the one screen. It worked back then. I think it would work great now, too. But as part of these changes and these smaller sets, Mike Johnson, the PW Insider guy, not the Speaker of the House, says that WWE will be cutting back on the amount of staff and equipment brought to the shows for lighting and production purposes. And they will also be cutting back on the number of production trucks at the events. But the best news of all is that as part of these changes, WWE is pulling back from a lot of the augmented reality content that they use on Raw and SmackDown. The plan is for that content to remain on pay-per-views, but not so much on the weekly shows. So another staple of the Kevin Dunn era dies a death. The augmented reality stuff, that's the giant CGI graphics that you see all over the screen when somebody comes out. Good riddance is what I say. Now on the corporate side, there were a couple of shakeups behind the scenes this week. Dan Ventrell, the vice president of talent, who was hired in September of 2022... was let go on Thursday. In a memo, Nick Khan said, WWE has begun the process of reorganizing its talent relations group. Moving forward, Chris LeGentle, in addition to his role in communications, will help us in leading this new group. Matt Altman, in addition to his role in marketing, will be working closely with Chris to help in this endeavor. I remember Matt Altman, he used to be their PR guy. Talent development and recruiting will now report into Shawn Michaels. All of talent, which includes talent relations, development, and recruiting, will continue to ultimately report into Paul Levesque. As of today, Dan Ventrell will be moving on from WWE. We thank Dan for his tremendous contributions. So HBK, in addition to heading up NXT, is now the number two man in talent relations. 25 years ago, the idea of Shawn Michaels being the one in charge of, or one of the heads in charge of talent relations, would have been laughable. Tell that to Jim Ross 25 years ago or 28 years ago, whatever. Hey, guess what? Shawn Michaels is going to be in your position leading talent relations one day. See what his reaction would have been. And look at him now. The Rock says, look at you now. Fightful Select is also reporting that Natalia's WWE deal is up in the next couple of months and that hers is one of many deals that Ventrell had not yet negotiated before his departure. Now, I initially read that as perhaps being a factor in why they let him go. Like, he dropped the ball and there were deals that should have been done that weren't. But it could also just mean that he had not yet had the chance to discuss new deals with them before they let him go. And that was a totally normal thing. In any event, he's gone, and I cannot see Natty going anywhere. I think even after she's done in the ring, she's got a lot to offer as a trainer, or even as a producer for them, like her husband. This other release was more surprising when I heard the name. Sue Aitchison, who had been with WWE dating all the way back to 1986 and received the Warrior Award at the Hall of Fame in 2019. She was the longest tenured employee in WWE. She was let go by the company on Friday. And she served as their director of community relations. She led a lot of their community outreach. And she was directly responsible for building WWE's relationship with the Make-A-Wish Foundation. And they've been working with Make-A-Wish forever, it feels like. She was the one who kickstarted that whole relationship. She also played, for those of you wondering what she looks like or if she's ever been on TV before, the answer is yes. She also played the Duchess of Queensberry in the Queensberry Rules match that William Regal had with Chris Jericho in 2001. There was another angle, and this is kind of an obscure reference, but there was an angle on SmackDown in 2002. And a lot of you will remember the angle. It's where Vince McMahon was interviewing in the ring. He was interviewing people to be his new personal assistant or secretary or whatever. And the payoff at the end was Stacy Keibler coming out and putting her legs on his shoulder. Again, every Vince McMahon segment is creepy as fuck when you look back at it. But in that segment, there was a woman who came down to the ring, a blonde woman, who said that her name was Sue Aitchison. But that was a rib. That was not actually Sue Aitchison. They just used her name. And I was always confused by this, because the woman that they used in the segment, it's not really relevant. Her name is Toni Starsson. She called herself Sue Aitchison in that segment. And so when the real Sue Aitchison was announced for the Warrior Award a few years ago, and she was at the Hall of Fame, I said, man, she must have gotten real old. Because she looked nothing like that other woman. Like, I'm looking and going, look, I know it's been 17 years or whatever. But like, holy shit, she looks like a totally different person. The woman in that segment with Vince McMahon who called herself Sue Aitchison, I remember her from a personal appearance that The Rock made at a car dealership here in Brooklyn. It was the day before The King of the Ring in 99. And she was there with him. She was kind of like the chaperone, I guess. And so now, a few years ago, I see Sue going into the Hall of Fame, and I'm like, there's no way. There's no way that this is the same person. This woman is a blonde. Sue Aitchison is out there. She's a gray-haired grandma. I mean, lovely lady, I'm sure. But yes, that was surprising to hear. I would say it's a sign of a new era with Endeavor, but honestly, I mean, they shit-canned Mark Eaton. Remember Mark Eaton, the timekeeper? He was the one who used to throw all the beers to Stone Cold. He was there for 30 years. And they got rid of him, right? No hesitation. And that was long before Endeavor came into the picture. I think they fired him 10 years ago. That's just the way it is. You know, when you outlive your usefulness and they're looking to save money, they kick you to the curb. No matter how well-liked you may be. And it's not like Mark Eaton was only a timekeeper. His only job was to ring the bell. He wore many hats, as a lot of those guys did. Howard Finkel wore a lot of hats. Tony Chimmel did a lot of things behind the scenes, not just ring announcing. But again, it doesn't matter how well-liked you are or how good you are at your job. When you outlive your usefulness, that's it. No one is guaranteed a lifetime position. Now, there was a Sports Illustrated story this week on Nick Khan. Couple of takeaways, but one key takeaway from it is how focused they are on international growth. When you see it all spelled out in the story like it was here, it just jumps out at you. So last year alone, they had Elimination Chamber in Montreal, Backlash in Puerto Rico, and yes, I know it's not technically international, but it's still a place they don't run shows on a regular basis. Money in the Bank was in London, plus the two Saudi Arabia shows. This year, they had Elimination Chamber in Perth. Backlash is coming to France in a few weeks. King and Queen of the Ring next month is in Saudi Arabia. Clash at the Castle is coming to Glasgow. Money in the Bank is in Toronto. And the Bash in Berlin is at the end of August. So they are more global now than they have ever been. The other key takeaway is that Nick Khan is more open than Vince McMahon was to collaborating with other wrestling promotions. So he was the one responsible for giving Paul Levesque the green light to work with Scott D'Amore before D'Amore got fired and bring in Jordan Grace, the TNA Knockouts champion, to be in the Royal Rumble this year. And he was also spotted at Josh Barnett's Bloodsport show where Shayna Baszler worked a match with Masha Slamovich last weekend. I guess the Thursday before WrestleMania. I think that's great. And I hope we get to see more collaboration with other promotions. I'm not interested in seeing WWE invade all of these different places, but just to be a little more open, you know, and to allow WWE talent, especially talent maybe that isn't being utilized a lot right now, to allow them the chance to work a match, maybe on a big show even here and there, or an independent show here and there. I think that's great. And I think keeping the lines of communication open in that way with other promotions is a positive. I mean, they even let Charlie Dempsey work a few All Japan shows at the beginning of the year. You know, he was wrestling for the Triple Crown. More of that. I want to see more of that. Milwaukee is hoping to land the Royal Rumble sometime in the near future. There was a story from the local CBS affiliate there that leaders have been in talks with WWE to pitch bringing a future Royal Rumble to the city, more specifically to American Family Field, which is the home of the Milwaukee Brewers. It's also a retractable roof stadium. It can open and close in under 10 minutes. It's got a capacity of only 42,000, but for a WWE show, they could probably fit closer to 50K in there, depending on how big the stage is. And usually in these baseball stadiums, we've seen a whole bunch of Royal Rumbles in baseball stadiums. Remember they had one in Minute Maid Park and a few other places. They usually just have the wrestlers come out from the dugout. It's not like you have this giant set with all these trons and everything. I mean, it's usually a very minimalist setup anyway. So they say the earliest that the Rumble could take place there would be 2026, which is when renovations to make it more winter-friendly would be completed. Their winterization project will allow the stadium to maintain a 70-degree temperature year-round. I'll bet those people at Lincoln Financial Field on night one wish that it was 70 degrees inside that stadium. And the Rumble would make more sense than SummerSlam because it doesn't, they don't have to worry about fitting it into the middle of the baseball season, so you're not going to do it in August. A source who was asked not to be identified because they did not want to share too much about the conversations said that city and state representatives met with the WWE officials in Philadelphia last weekend during the company's biggest annual event, WrestleMania. While WrestleMania is probably out of Milwaukee's reach, city and state officials hope to attract WWE's next biggest draw on the calendar. So we may be getting a WrestleMania in Minnesota soon, and then a Royal Rumble in Wisconsin. The cheese state. That'd be like throwing Superman into a vat of kryptonite. I'm staying away from that. We have the dates for the WWE draft. It begins April 26th on SmackDown, continues into Raw the following Monday. They have not said anything about champions being ineligible to be drafted, which they really should be. You know, at least the top men's and women's champions really should not be able to be traded away. I mean, I know why they like keeping it open like that, because it creates chaos. You never know. You know, the top champion on Raw could end up on SmackDown, and the U.S. title and the Intercontinental title could swap brands. I think at least the top champions should be draft ineligible. We also know that NXT will be involved. The NXT champion Ilya Dragunov worked a match against Shinsuke Nakamura on Monday. And the new NXT women's champion, Roxanne Perez, she worked a match against Indy Hartwell, just to drive home the fact that either one of them or both of them could potentially end up being drafted. NXT should always be involved in the draft. I mean, why wouldn't they be? Why wouldn't the general managers want to bring some of that young talent up to their shows? The only thing that's kind of silly about this whole thing is what a big deal they made of Nick Aldis and Adam Pearce fighting to sign people like Bron Breakker and Jade Cargill. Only for there to be a draft 2 months later where presumably both of them could be drafted to the other show. I mean, they did a whole thing with Bron Breakker where he was in the aisleway with Nick Aldis holding his contract open and posing. 2 months later or 2.5 months later, he could be drafted to Monday Night Raw. I think there should be some kind of draft protection that prevents anyone from being moved to the other show if they were signed by either GM in the last 90 days. This is not something WWE gets into the weeds with, because to them, this is not that deep. It's not that big of a deal. I'm just saying, as a fan who pays attention to this stuff because I'm a wrestling fucking nerd, I think that would make sense, right? Anybody who the GM of either show has signed in the last 90 days, they have to stay where they are. They too are not eligible for the draft. That's what I would like to see them do. But when we get a little bit closer, we have a few weeks, I will go over some draft moves that I would make. The big news coming out of Raw Monday night. was The Rock, putting Cody Rhodes on notice that he is leaving, but when he comes back, whether Cody is still WWE champion or not, he's coming for him. Said, Cody, you beat Roman Reigns on night two, but I pinned you on night one. Your story with Roman Reigns is over, but our story has just begun. And he also asked Cody if he could hold his new championship, and Cody told him, sure, if you let me hold yours, right? The Rock's Brahma Bull Belt, the People's Championship. You can hold mine if you let me hold yours. The sexual tension between these two was palpable. This was Rock's way of showing Cody, you know, his dominance. He's the alpha male here. I'm coming for your title when I come back. And then at the very end, Rock reached into his pocket and he placed something in Cody's hand. And he told Cody, you don't even need to look in your hand to know what this is. Don't you ever break my heart again. Now, everybody has a theory about what was in Rock's hand. At first, I wasn't sure that there was anything in Rock's hand. I thought maybe it was just a symbolic gesture of some kind. But everybody has a theory about what was in Rock's hand. The more I think about it, him telling Cody, you don't even need to look in your hand to know what this is. Maybe it was a lighter. Since Cody's tour bus caught fire the Thursday before WrestleMania, which is a real story. I mean, it really did catch on fire, and he thanked the Philadelphia police, fire department rather, for being on the scene, and nobody was hurt, thank God. So maybe they're giving Rock credit, or they're going to give Rock credit for trying to burn down his bus, because Cody broke his heart and stole his WrestleMania match with Roman Reigns. I don't know. Cody never showed what was in his hand. I assume when the time is right and The Rock comes back, they will tell us. So we are definitely getting The Rock one-on-one with Cody Rhodes. It's just a matter of when, it is not a matter of if. Rock came back to work a match against his cousin. That was the original idea. He was coming back, and he was going to finally work a match against Roman Reigns that they've been teasing for years and years and years. And the way things ended up working out, now he ends up getting at least three matches out of it, including the tag match they did on night one last weekend. Then a match with Cody, and then the eventual match with Roman Reigns. They fucked up, and they fell ass backwards into an even better plan. Right now, Rock is off to film a movie. That's not going to wrap up until July. So SummerSlam, it's possible. I don't know how likely it is, but it's possible. To me, SummerSlam is what would make the most sense. To do Rock against Cody. Meltzer in this week's Observer says Rock would prefer to work Cody in the main event of next year's WrestleMania. Now, Rock is very big on one-year builds. He did it with John Cena for both of their matches, and he would have done the same thing with Brock Lesnar for WrestleMania 30 had he not gotten hurt against Cena at 29. They were going to shoot the angle for it on Raw the next night. I don't think you wait until 41 to do Rock and Cody. I think you do it at SummerSlam, and you save Rock against Roman for 41. You know, Rock's not getting any younger. And to wait another 2 years and say, okay, we'll do Rock and Roman at 42... I mean, look, Undertaker and Triple H and Shawn Michaels, they had like a 4-year story arc at WrestleMania. It's not like it's impossible to play the long game here and say, okay, you know what, we'll wait until 2026 and then we'll do Rock against Roman. But there's so many variables involved here between his age and his schedule. If that's the plan and you're setting that as the plan and then something comes up and it doesn't happen, I don't think you want to be waiting that long to do the match. Cody, meanwhile, is defending the WWE title against either AJ Styles or LA Knight, whoever wins their match on SmackDown this Friday. I was saying it for weeks before Mania that AJ would make a great first challenger for Cody Rhodes. And then he lost to LA Knight at WrestleMania. But I'll bet he's winning that match on Friday, and he's going to be getting that match at Backlash. They did the same thing with AJ when he debuted in 2016. He lost to Chris Jericho at WrestleMania, and then he went on to challenge Roman Reigns the next 2 months in back-to-back pay-per-view main events for the WWE title. And he lost both matches. But he gave Roman some of his best. He's 8 years older now. It's not quite the same AJ Styles, but he's still pretty damn good. I think he's a great choice. I'm sure it will not be a clean win over LA Knight this Friday. You save LA Knight for a title that he actually has a chance of winning. You save him for the United States Championship. The other news coming out of Raw is that Jey Uso is now number one contender for the World Heavyweight Championship after winning a fatal four-way match over Drew McIntyre, Ricochet, and Bronson Reed. He will challenge Damian Priest for the title at Backlash. I'll get back to that in a few minutes because I think I know exactly how that's going to play out. Chad Gable is getting his shot at Sami Zayn and the Intercontinental title in Sami's hometown of Montreal tomorrow night. I'm very much looking forward to that match. They've also announced the return of Sheamus. He is back on Raw tomorrow night. And that got me thinking. Cody has finished his story, but Sheamus still has his, which is the Intercontinental title. And then you look at the Raw roster as it stands right now. I know we have a draft coming up, but who else is on Raw? You got Drew McIntyre, right? He's already worked with McIntyre before as partners and as adversaries. Gunther, he's already worked with him. What else is Sheamus going to do in coming back to Monday Night Raw? He is going to want to go after the Intercontinental title. So don't be surprised if Sheamus comes back as a heel and he interferes in that Sami Zayn-Chad Gable match tomorrow night and we end up getting a no contest. He injects himself right into the Intercontinental title picture. He ends up winning the title before Gable ever does. Whether that's Backlash or Clash at the Castle, they could have Sheamus against Sami Zayn on that show. Sheamus finally wins. He finally wins the Intercontinental title. And Chad Gable, if he is ever going to win that damn title, has to beat Sheamus to do it, not Sami Zayn. That way Gable doesn't have to turn heel. They're obviously doing something with Chad Gable. Is he going to go heel and snap after he loses to Sami tomorrow night, if that's the way it plays out? Or they could go in a different direction and they could do something like this. Because you could do that. He could have a great match with Sami. Sami could win on a fluke, right? It could have gone either way, but Sami Zayn retains, and that just drives him just right off the edge of the cliff. And we get heel Chad Gable. You bring Sheamus into the mix, though. It makes things even more interesting, and it eliminates the need for Gable to have to go heel. Then on SmackDown, we fast forward to Friday. We had some big developments in the Bloodline story. They saved the big surprise debut for Friday instead of Monday after WrestleMania. No Roman Reigns, no Rock, but Paul Heyman was out with Solo Sikoa and Jimmy Uso, talking about accountability and how the Tribal Chief wants accountability, and they need to bring the title back to the Bloodline. Winning and losing has consequences, he said. If, of course, if that were true, Solo Sikoa would have been kicked out of the Bloodline months ago. But instead it was Solo who took out his brother Jimmy for losing to Jey Uso at WrestleMania. He should have attacked him for having such a terrible match. That should have been the reason why he was attacked. Maybe it was. Maybe that was the real reason why he was so violent with all those Samoan spikes. So he attacked his brother, but not before Jimmy got jumped by the debuting Tama Tonga. From Bullet Club to Bloodline. 14 years with New Japan Pro Wrestling. He finally made the jump. And you know what? For all the people who might look at this and go, man, the guy's 40 years old or 41, whatever it is, and he spent so many years, well over a decade in New Japan, and he should have made the jump a lot sooner, you know, when he was a little bit younger. Well, I'll tell you what, it looks like he picked a hell of a time to make the jump, didn't he? I would say he nailed the timing. The timing could not have been better for him. Solo ends up killing Jimmy with a hip attack in the corner to a chair wrapped around Jimmy's neck. They left him for dead. Paul Heyman is horrified. This was not ordered by the Tribal Chief, he says. He goes to call Roman Reigns. Solo swipes the phone out of his hand and stomps on it. And then in the back later, Tama tells Heyman that it was by the order of the Tribal Chief. And Solo smiles and he walks off with him. And Heyman has no idea what the hell that means. What it means is that we are now in for a new chapter of this story, and it could not come a day too soon. Because before The Rock came back, the Bloodline story was treading water. Rock going heel breathed new life into it, but now Rock is leaving. Roman is not full-time. This had to happen. They needed to shake things up and add new members if they wanted to keep this story rolling along. We've had almost 4 years of the Bloodline. This fall is going to be 4 years of this Bloodline story. When we first saw Jay and Roman, you know, linking up together as part of a group. Now, we move on to the Bloodline Civil War. Jacob Fatu has also signed with WWE. He was backstage at WrestleMania. I have been waiting for Fatu to become a free agent because he should have been part of this a long time ago. I don't think that we're going to have to wait very long to see him. I mentioned before, Jey Uso is going to be challenging Damian Priest for the World Heavyweight title. I assume that's going to be at Backlash. They haven't made that official yet. I could see Jacob Fatu debuting on that show as the newest addition to this new bloodline, costing Jey Uso the world title. There needs to be a way to work Jey back into the bloodline story. He beat Jimmy at WrestleMania. This is their way of getting back at him. Fatu cost him the match. So now we've got Solo, we've got Tama, and we would have Fatu. Does that make Solo Sikoa the new tribal chief, since Roman Reigns said he was next in line? I think it does, but not because Roman anointed him, because The Rock did. And what we're looking at here is going to be Roman's bloodline, ultimately, against The Rock's bloodline, to build to the eventual Rock versus Roman match, which is why I also think that should be the match for 41, not 42. And that means that when Roman Reigns comes back, he's going to have to make amends with his cousin. Both of his cousins, but especially with Jey Uso. Roman is going to have to confront all of the turmoil that he himself has caused. Right? That's a whole plot twist in and of itself. The Usos reuniting, and then Roman reunites with them both to take on Solo, Tama, and Fatu. Where does Paul Heyman's loyalty lie in all this? Is it with the tribal chief, or is it with the final boss? Right? That could be another layer to the story. All of a sudden, the bloodline has new life to it. And now they have my attention. Honestly, Jacob Fatu would make a far better tribal chief than Solo Sikoa would. That really should have been his role. Had he been available sooner, that would have been the perfect role for him. I don't see him as a follower, I see him as a leader himself. But Fatu and Tama tagging up would be cool, since their fathers were the Islanders in WWE. I remember when they dog-napped Matilda from the British Bulldogs. CM Punk better keep them away from Larry. But this is how Roman Reigns ends up as a mega babyface, and that had to always be the plan. Once he lost the title, you know, the biggest heels eventually become the biggest babyfaces. The only difference is this time, he'll be over organically, and not because he was being force-fed to people against their will. And now I see Fightful is reporting that Hikuleo's deal with New Japan is set to expire in June. He's Tama Tonga's half-brother. The bloodline will never end. If you are not a fan of the bloodline, but you are in for a world of hurt, the bloodline is never going to end. Roman Reigns is going to be looking like Afa and Sika, and this storyline is still going to be going. All these people shaking their head, man, when will the bloodline end, boy? You know, I'll tell you what, I got something for you guys. I got the perfect thing for you guys. You know what you need? You need BetterHelp. That's what you need. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, coming out of WrestleMania weekend, I can say that my social battery is basically running on empty right now. This time of year for me is usually my busiest. There's so much going on. I don't leave enough time for anything else, and I tend to not be as social until the weather gets nicer anyway. It could be very easy to spread myself thin with work. I need to change that. For some of you, your social battery may be low because you don't like hanging around other people to begin with, or maybe life just has you very worn down. Therapy can give you the self-awareness that you need to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Since you first started hearing me talk about BetterHelp, I've gotten messages from people that have taken advantage of the service telling me how much it's really helped them with whatever problems they may have been dealing with. Therapy in general can have so many benefits for you. Just having someone to talk to and to get that guidance. Maybe you don't have the motivation or the confidence on your own or the knowledge even on how best to deal with the stress and the anxiety that you're probably going through right now. It can be life-changing for you. And it isn't just for people that have been through a trauma in their lives, but it can certainly help you there too if you have. If you're thinking of starting therapy, do yourself a favor. Give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be flexible enough to fit into your schedule. To get started, you just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and they make it incredibly easy to switch therapists at any time for no additional charge if you need to do so. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/solomonster today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, help.com/solomonster. If you've been thinking about it, seriously, don't put it off. That's what the offer is there for. Make sure you take advantage of it. BetterHelp.com Solomonster. Last weekend, when everybody was busy watching WrestleMania and talking about WWE, on Collision, AEW announced they would be airing backstage footage from Wembley Stadium 7 months ago of the altercation between CM Punk and Jack Perry. And they never mentioned them by name, but it was implied that that's what it would be. Tony Khan told Sports Illustrated, the decision is based on putting on the best show for AEW as well as driving interest for Dynamite and our Dynasty pay-per-view on April 21st. When I first heard that they were doing this, I thought it was a terrible idea. Just reeked of desperation and insecurity after CM Punk went on Ariel Helwani's show and he gave his side of the story about what happened at Wembley that night. Because he was asked about it, not because he volunteered it, because Ariel asked him questions and he answered those questions. This had less to do with Tony wanting to incorporate this into a storyline and more to do with refuting what Punk had to say. If Punk doesn't go on Ariel, this footage never airs. There's no way. But I said, okay, I'll watch the footage. Let's see what happens. Let's see what it shows. Well, I watched it and it went pretty much the way that Punk said it did. It had no audio. Because it was security camera footage, so we couldn't hear what was being said. But I felt the same way I did going into it. This had no business airing on TV. Not now. Had Tony wanted to air it after he fired Punk, like that week of, or that week after. Remember when he went out there on Collision? I know it was like a pre-tape at the beginning of the show, but he actually went out for 10 minutes in front of the live crowd to the point where he brought a chair out on stage so he could take a seat. While he was begging the people basically not to boo him and to see his side of the story, and he talked about how he feared for his life. If he wanted to show the footage then, fine. Show the footage and explain to people why you just fired the biggest star in your company. Here's why we felt we had to do this. This was his second altercation in less than a year. This was not the first time that he's gotten physical and handsy with people in the back. You don't wait 7 months because you're upset over what he said in a YouTube interview. You're upset that he called you a clown. This was very reactionary. That's why this aired. That and to pop a rating. And to that end, Tony happily tweeted on Thursday, just got the great news from TBS. Last night, Wednesday Night Dynamite, up 29% from last week and up 17% over the prior 6 week average. Congratulations. It was able to lift the show up to 819,000 viewers. And the Punk footage did the second highest quarter hour of the show, 880,000, second only to the opening segment that did 981,000. I hope he enjoyed the bump. So when the numbers go back down this week, what's he going to do next? Because I don't see how airing that footage and folding it into this Young Bucks FTR storyline heading into Dynasty is going to add a single new viewer to the show. It showed Jack Perry at Gorilla having just come back from his match with Hook, who's also just standing around. Samoa Joe can be seen in the corner. He's pacing back and forth, getting ready for his match when Punk walks up to Jack Perry and starts talking to him. Now, Punk in his interview with Ariel said that he walked up to Jack and said, why do you insist on doing that dumb internet shit on TV? And he claims that Perry said, well, if you got a problem with it, do something about it. And we can't verify it because we can't hear what they're actually saying to each other. Punk, though, said in that interview, he says, it's like the Chael Sonnen thing. Sometimes you just can't let them get close. That ignores the fact that it was Punk who walked up to Jack Perry. Not the other way around. I mean, to hear him say use a line like that, you would think that Perry was practically headbutting him, getting up in his face, or Perry went to go seek him out, or Perry got to the back and he saw Punk getting ready for his match and he mouthed off to him. Punk went and found Jack Perry and got up in his face. Not only did Punk, who should have been getting ready to go out for his world title match, decide that now would be a good time to go find Jungle Boy and stir things up, at no point during their face-to-face did Jack Perry make a move towards Punk or act aggressive towards Punk. Do you know what he did? Do you know what Jack Perry did in this footage? He fixed his hair like he was getting ready to go to the salon to get his hair did. He fixed his hair. This led to Punk giving him a hard shove. Now, again, we don't know what Jack Perry said to him. Jack Perry could have said, fuck your mother. I'm willing to bet he didn't. We don't know what Jack Perry said. But the point is, he didn't put his hands on Punk. He never got aggressive towards Punk. Never got physically aggressive. Didn't get up in his space. Didn't make a lunge or a move towards him. But it led to Punk giving him a hard shove and then putting him in a front face lock. And remember what Punk told Ariel? I thought I was doing the responsible thing. I didn't punch him. I just choked him a little bit. The responsible thing would have been to not confront the man before going out for your match. That would have been the responsible thing. Joe sees this. He immediately runs over to pull Jack away from Punk. Punk was restrained by three different people. Paul Turner was there, the referee, Jerry Lynn. Punk made a move towards Tony Khan, who we couldn't see. We could see Tony's hand. He kind of reached over to stop his flat panel from falling over when they kind of bumped into the table. Punk made a move towards him. While he was being held back, he was clearly shouting something at Tony. We couldn't hear what. Punk says that he told Tony, this place is a fucking joke. You're a clown. I quit. At which point, Chris Hero gets up from behind the desk to try to calm him down. Punk turns and walks away. Hero puts his hands on his face, like Kevin McAllister in Home Alone when he put the aftershave on his face. Evidently, this is what made Tony Khan fear for his life. I still can't believe he actually went out in front of that Chicago crowd and in front of the world in that other segment on television and said that. It is one of the most embarrassing things I have ever seen. It was embarrassing when he said it, and now that we saw what went down, it's even more embarrassing. And so was this. I can't even really call it a fight or a brawl. But he still put his hands on Jack Perry. Perry never laid a finger on him. Kenny Omega on his Twitch stream. He opened up about Brawl Out the other day. From Brawl In, back to Brawl Out. I don't know what these people can and cannot say about Brawl Out. I thought that they couldn't say anything. He did not divulge much in the way of specific details. You know, what happened when the Bucks approached Punk and came into his locker room, and who got physical first. By most reports, it was Punk who threw a punch because he felt threatened. And then chairs were flying, and Ace Steel went into vampire mode. I mean, there was a lot of shit that went down. And Kenny Omega did not get into any of those specifics other than to confirm that his primary concern was getting Larry the dog, Punk's dog, since they were in Chicago, he had his dog at the building, getting Larry out of harm's way. He said his status right now, when he was asked, his status with CM Punk is mutual respect. He said they reached out to each other after the incident, which was reported. And he made it sound like, look, he would have had no issue doing business with him after that. Unlike the Young Bucks, who obviously wanted nothing to do with CM Punk. And that was always the impression that I got, was that Omega was cool with Punk and the two would have gladly worked together, and I think that would have been a hell of a match. But it was the larger elite that did not want to. And I can't even say whether Hangman Page would have been open to working with Punk or not, because he hasn't said a word and nobody has said anything about where his mind or his head is at on it, but the Bucks obviously did not want to. And I've addressed why I think it was a terrible idea for them not to agree to at least sit down with Punk, and the Bucks are culpable for that. But anyway, the reason I bring this up about Omega talking about Brawl Out is because Omega also said, you know, sometimes it's okay for guys to fight and just get things out of their system and just, you know, throw down. And that may be true. And there's been plenty of that has happened in wrestling over the years. And this is what people who have been coming at me all week don't seem to understand. Yes, I am not blind to the fact that there are scuffles that happen behind the scenes or at the gorilla position. Tensions flare, emotions get high, guys get, you know, into a verbal argument, and then they end up rolling around on the ground or they throw a punch at the other guy. This has happened for years and years and years. You can probably come up with various examples of this happening. The difference here is that may be the case when both parties are ready to throw down. We don't know what Jack Perry said to Punk. Punk is the one who initiated contact, and it was not the first time that he had done so with somebody backstage at an AEW event. There is a reason why Bryan Danielson recommended that Tony get rid of him. And Bryan Danielson is not a Punk hater. Bryan Danielson said it was like the most difficult decision he ever had to make. He doesn't hate CM Punk. But he's an adult, and he recognized that Punk had to go. This was not the first time we had something like this happen backstage. That does not absolve Tony Khan from any blame. He is as much to blame in any of this as CM Punk is. But Tony can't fire himself, right? That's just not going to happen. when it was over, when this whole thing was over and they aired the footage, and it literally was like maybe a minute and 10 seconds. It wasn't that long. When this was over, I did not think any more of CM Punk. I did not think any less of CM Punk. But I did think less of Tony Khan for airing this on TV. Now, they would justify it by saying that it's a way to build to Jack Perry's return to TV. They just added a ladder match stipulation for the Bucks and FTR at Dynasty. So it looks like Perry is going to help the Bucks win the tag team titles and then probably will end up as part of the Elite. And they have to try to use this in some way now. If they're going to bring back Jack Perry, they have to try to use this in some way. But that footage does not air on Wednesday if Punk does not go on Ariel's show the previous Monday. It is sad to see Tony Khan still relying on CM Punk, a man who has not worked for his company in 7 months, to pop a number. It's like Vince McMahon promoting the returns of Diesel and Razor Ramon to get a ratings boost and then giving us fake Razor and fake Diesel. At least Tony actually delivered on what he advertised. But I wish he hadn't. So what do they follow that up with? Will Ospreay coming out and taking a shot at Paul Levesque for a comment that he made on the Pat McAfee show that Ospreay thought was directed at him. And it clearly was, although Levesque never mentioned him by name. He comes out on stage with Renee, and he says, Tony told him he's only got 5 minutes because TV time is expensive. Yeah, it's so expensive you wasted it on having him take a shot at Triple H and airing security camera footage from 7 months ago. The comment that Triple H, for context here, the comment that Triple H made, it was very petty. He said, when I see people trying to make it, and they pick the job where they go, well, I work less and the schedule is lighter. Okay, I'm glad I didn't get you. Because if you're not in it for the grind at that point in your career, you have no business being here. In his promo, Ospreay said there's this rumor going around that he is afraid of the grind. And he has no idea where this is coming from because he's one of the only guys traveling back and forth from the UK to the US 8 to 10 hours a week, delivering some of the best pro wrestling matches this business has ever seen. And normally, he said he wouldn't even respond to something like this, but seeing as how the man who said it is only in the position he's in because he was grinding on the boss's daughter, you are in no position to tell him what the grind is all about. So let this be a painful little jab back and a reminder that you do not throw stones at an assassin with a machine gun. Now, this was said to be Ospreay's idea, or it was pitched to him, and he was all in on doing it. And it's not even a big deal that he did it. He took a jab back at Triple H. But doing it on the same show as the Punk stuff, and giving it any attention at all on TV, can we not? Can we not be doing this? It was a stupid thing for Triple H to say. Especially when Ospreay had good reasons for going with AEW. It was not just a money thing. He had conversations. He had discussions with WWE and was very seriously considering which move to make. Ultimately, they wanted him to move to the United States, which would have been the case with anybody they would have signed. Okada too. They want you to be based in the US. They want you to probably go down to Florida and be close to the Performance Center. But they want you to be based in the US. He did not want to do that because it would force his girlfriend and stepson to move with him, or they wouldn't move with him and then he would never get to see them. So he put family first. Family should always come first. I respect him for it. To be honest with you, I mean, if he was in a position where he's got two different offers here, and let's say the money is comparable. Let's say the money isn't even all that different, although he probably got a higher money offer from Tony Khan because Tony Khan's been throwing around money like it's going out of style and now talking about how he's got to watch the budget because he's overspent. Yeah, no shit. But let's even say the money offers were comparable. But in AEW, where he has plenty of people he's friendly with and plenty of people to work with, you're not going to be forced to have to uproot your life and move to the U.S., and in the other case, you are going to have to uproot your life and move to the U.S. And it could affect other people. It could affect your own relationships. Which decision are you going to make? I would have made the same decision that Will Ospreay did. You can dangle the WrestleMania carrot in front of my face all you want to. I would have made the exact same choice. I don't find any fault in him for the choice that he made. And I wouldn't say that this guy does. He's not ready for the grind. because he put family first. If Triple H is salty that he missed out on Ospreay and he missed out on Okada, then let him be salty. Ospreay's body of work speaks for itself. But the sad thing is that the two things that people were talking about coming out of that show on Wednesday, I mean, the primary thing was Punk and Jack Perry and a fucking show from August. But the two things were Brawl In and the shot that Will Ospreay took at Paul Levesque. When they should have been talking about Samoa Joe and Swerve Strickland closing out the show and going into Dynasty. Swerve Strickland, who's about to win his first AEW world title. And Adam Copeland, who I thought had a fun match with Penta for the TNT title to open up the show. That did the biggest quarter hour of anything on the show. Completely overshadowed by all of this other garbage. Some other notes. Was that Athena that I saw on my TV screen last night during Battle of the Belts? It was. Defending her Ring of Honor Women's World title against Red Velvet. It was only her second televised AEW match in the last 2 years. I don't know why all of the other Ring of Honor champions get so much more airtime on TV than she does, but it was good to see her come out of hiding. It's like she's been in witness protection. There was also a report from SEScoops.com that Hook plans to explore free agency when his AEW contract expires later this year. I am sure the WWE would be interested in him. I don't know why they wouldn't be. I'm sure Shawn Michaels would love to get his hands on him at the Performance Center. And honestly, I mean, I can't get in the man's head, so I don't know, but I do wonder if Taz might feel the same. And AEW has announced its entire pay-per-view schedule for the remainder of 2024. They hosted 8 pay-per-views in total in 2023. This year, that number moves up to 9. And we already had Revolution last month, so up next it is Dynasty, which is in St. Louis, Missouri on April 21st. Double or Nothing is back in Las Vegas at the MGM Grand Garden Arena on May 26th. I don't think they've been in that building since the first one. Sunday, June 30th. Forbidden Door from the UBS Arena in Elmont, New York. Andrew Zarian had reported that the show originally was going to emanate from Arthur Ashe Stadium, where they usually do Dynamite Grand Slam in September, but then announced that it was no longer being held there, and I think he said it might have had something to do with New Japan not wanting to share in the production costs, which Rocky Romero quote tweeted and said this is not true. Well, the show is not being held at Arthur Ashe. We know that is true. It is being held at the UBS Arena on Long Island. So maybe that means MJF will be back before then. Sunday, August 25th is All In at Wembley Stadium. Make sure the cameras in the back are rolling. Sunday, September 1st, All Out is back at Hoffman Estates, Illinois. Chicago, as everybody will call it. So they are sticking with the back-to-back pay-per-view weekends. This is going to be the annual thing now. Saturday, October 12th. Wrestle Dream from the Tacoma Dome in Tacoma, Washington. Last year's show was in Seattle, so they are staying in Washington. Saturday, November 23rd, which is the Saturday before Thanksgiving, Full Gear from the Prudential Center in Newark, New Jersey. And Saturday, December 28th, World's End from Addition Financial Arena in Orlando, Florida. That is among the more terrible arena names. Still not as bad as Guaranteed Rate Field, though, where the White Sox play. That's still the worst. Chad Rowan, better known as Akebono, who worked a sumo match at WrestleMania 1 year against The Big Show, died earlier this month of heart failure at the age of 54. His family announced this week he was a big dude, 6'8", almost 500 pounds, probably over 500 pounds during his heyday. The first non-Japanese-born wrestler to ever reach Yokozuna status, the highest rank in sumo. He beat Big Show in a sumo rules match at WrestleMania 21, where we got to see more of Big Show than I ever wanted to in my life. And that wasn't even the most embarrassing thing he ever did in that company. O.J. Simpson also died this week at the age of 76. I see that cancer did what Fred Goldman wished he could have done. The murder trial of the century. I remember it like it was yesterday. Biggest media event in the world. He gets acquitted. I will never forget the look on Robert Kardashian's face when they read that verdict and he heard that his client got off. Even he couldn't believe it. He knew. He knew the deal. But he got paid very well to defend him. They all did. That's why they call them the Dream Team. So naturally, Vince McMahon, why am I mentioning this? Vince McMahon wanted to bring OJ in for a killer match with Roddy Piper at WrestleMania 12. And they even had talks with OJ's people about setting the whole thing up. The idea was that Piper would beat the shit out of him. So that would make it okay if he got to beat up or fake beat up OJ Simpson in a wrestling match. Once word leaked out about their plans, they started to get backlash for it, and they realized, you know what, this is probably a bad idea. You don't say. They still incorporated footage of the OJ Bronco chase into the backlot brawl that Piper had with Goldust. See, they wanted controversy. So they got cold feet on OJ, so they decided, you know what, Goldust was controversial enough, we'll go with that instead. And Mick Foley is no longer planning to return to the ring for one last death match next year for his 60th birthday. He said he wanted to lose weight. He was using that as motivation to reach his goal. But last month he suffered a bout of dizziness. He had to pull out of some personal appearances. At first he thought it was from not getting enough sleep and driving too much. But after consulting with his doctors, it appears he suffered a concussion and didn't even know it. So he is no longer planning on one final match, and he made it very clear in the video he posted that his family was also very much against this idea. I get the sense that the family probably had the final word in all this. I was against the idea the minute he pitched it. I'm surprised the man is able to get around at all and do all the appearances that he does with all the abuse that his body and his brain have taken. No one is clamoring for one more Mick Foley match. I have too much respect for the guy to want to see him go out there and hurt himself or embarrass himself when he doesn't need to. I mean, before he would get concussed from taking bumps and taking chair shots to the head. Now he's getting concussed and he doesn't even know why. That's a sign. Thankfully, he came to his senses. So I did not get a chance to review the Harley Race episode of Dark Side of the Ring last week because of all the WrestleMania madness. I watched it, but I didn't put any notes or anything together. But enough people sent me messages asking about it, so what I'm going to do here, I'm going to do a review of that, and then I'm going to move on to the most recent episode on Chris Colt. So you're getting a double review here. First, Handsome Harley Race, 8 times NWA World Champion and the first ever United States Champion. I thought the episode was good, incomplete, as most of these are due to time constraints, but it was good. The thing you already hear about Harley is how tough he is. And, you know, given some of the things that he went through in his life as far as injuries and tragedy, you know, he was definitely tough. But he also beat up his wife, which I did not know. And it doesn't take much of a tough guy to do that. So that was disappointing to hear. Jim Cornette made the episode stronger, as he did with the Chris Colt one, because he's a great historian, you know. He's perfect for these types of shows. And Trevor Murdoch was interviewed. He was trained by Harley, and he said Harley told him most of these stories personally. Mick Foley was interviewed. He was inspired by Harley because he was the first man he ever saw take a clothesline to the floor and a backdrop to the floor. Harley was innovative. There's a lot of spots that you see today that were taken from him, or he was the first one to popularize it. The Triple H bump, where he would be whipped into the corner and he would go flying out over the top rope. That was a Harley Race bump. Triple H got it from Harley. Ric Flair got it from Harley. The flying headbutt was a Harley Race move. He was doing table spots years before anybody else was doing them. They interviewed his ex-wife, who was married to Harley for 24 years. Before that, though, he got married at the age of 17. And his wife was pregnant with their first child. And they gave the short version in the episode, but straight from Harley's book was the first major car accident that he was in, which nearly ended his career before it had a chance to get started. He had only been wrestling for a couple of years by this point. And it was Christmas night. He and his wife had just married, I think, the month before. On one side of the road, coming up the hill, is Harley's car. On the other side of the road is a tractor trailer loaded with eggs. Neither can see the other over the hill, and they're just barreling towards each other. The tractor trailer swerves, it jackknifes, the cab and the trailer slam into Harley's car. His wife is pronounced dead at the scene, including their unborn child. Harley doesn't know from any of this because Harley is unconscious. He's pronounced dead too. They can't get a pulse on him. Only when he started moving in the ambulance, then they realize, oh shit, this guy's still alive. A few days later, he regains consciousness. He asks the doctor, where's my wife? And the doctor says, what wife? You don't have a wife. And he said he knows the doctor was just being ignorant when he said that, but if he was physically able to, he would have gotten up out of that bed and that would have been the end of the doctor. And I believe it. So his wife is dead, his unborn child is gone, and now they want to amputate one of his legs because he's so badly injured. And that would have been the end of his career. And it was only when the promoter, Gus Karras, he showed up at the hospital, he was able to convince the doctors to let them go get a second opinion at a different hospital. And they did get that second opinion, and they were able to save Harley's leg. It's like the Lex Luger story. I mean, Luger tells of his motorcycle accident. His arm was in such horrible shape, they wanted to amputate his arm. And I think Sting was there, and Sting was raising holy hell, and he got in touch, I think, with the promoter, and they were able to get him a second opinion, and that saved Luger's arm. I mean, what is it, the first thing these people think of? Let's just cut it off? Yeah, not much we can do here. Let's just cut the fucking thing off. So then he was told he would never walk again, let alone wrestle. And he claims he told the doctor, I'll send you ringside tickets to my first match back. And for the rest of his life, he hated Christmas because of the trauma from the accident. He always associated that with that holiday. His ex-wife says that he was only going 30 miles an hour down the road when he had that accident that killed his first wife. After that, he never followed the speed limit ever again. And that's all you ever hear, are stories about what a maniac Harley was on the road. She says if the sign said 70, he would be going 90. And that's what, he was notorious for that. That, you're driving fast and drinking beer while he drove. A great combination. He won his first NWA title in 1973, and at that point he was a made man. He was so important to the Central States territory in Kansas, they let him buy into it. So he owned a piece of it. And he dropped the title to Ric Flair. It was the main event, very first Starrcade, 1983. But not before Vince McMahon tried to steal him away. Vince McMahon doing Vince McMahon things. Now, Vince McMahon knew that Harley was about to drop this belt to Ric Flair. I guess it was probably common knowledge at that time that that's what this whole Starrcade event was being built towards. And he also knew that he was about to go national. And he wanted to screw around with Flair getting the belt. So 2 days before Starrcade, okay, 2 days before Thanksgiving, Harley gets a call from Vince. He wants to fly Harley up to Connecticut the next day to meet with him, which was the day before Starrcade. And in his book, Harley admitted, he goes, you know, he was depressed about dropping the belt to Flair because back then being the champion meant you made the most money and all the fame that came with it. So he agreed. He said, okay, I'll meet with you. I'll hear what he has to say. As the story goes, Vince wanted him to no-show Starrcade and come work for him. And he promised Harley a $250,000 signing bonus if he did so. And it's not like Vince doesn't have a history of these things. I mean, he tried to get Mike Goldberg to do the same thing in 2005. He wanted him to no-show a UFC pay-per-view and come, you know, be his new play-by-play announcer on Raw to replace Jim Ross, because forever and a day, Vince McMahon and Kevin Dunn were constantly trying to replace Jim Ross. So Harley, ultimately, he says, out of loyalty, he just can't bring himself to do it. So he declines. Now, they're at a restaurant meeting when this is all happening, and he declines. As they're leaving the restaurant, this is according to Harley in his book, says Vince and Linda, they're walking a little bit ahead of him and his wife, and he can see Vince's whole demeanor change, like the way he's walking with more of a swagger. I picture the Vince McMahon strut as he's leaving the restaurant. All of a sudden, Vince turns around and he leg dives Harley Race. He leg dives the NWA world champion, which sounds like a terrible idea. He's trying to take this man down. Harley cross faces Vince with his left arm and says he could have snapped his neck with the other one, or I guess with the left arm. He could have snapped his neck if he wanted to. And his wife told him not to do it, so he let go. In the episode, the story is that he choked Vince McMahon unconscious. And so the main event of Starrcade went off as planned, and Flair got his big moment. That could have changed history, had Harley agreed to do it, because 2 months later is when Vince McMahon put the world title on Hulk Hogan. Had Harley come in as the NWA champion, would that have changed Vince McMahon's plans? I say probably not. He probably would have just brought him in and paid him very well to have Hogan beat him, so that he could say Hulk Hogan defeated the real NWA World Champion. Hogan is now the undisputed, you know, wrestling champion. I doubt Vince McMahon gave a shit about Harley Race himself. He just wanted to fuck with the NWA. This was not about signing Harley Race. And that wasn't the only Vince story that, you know, they shared a long-told story here in this episode, long-told by Hulk Hogan. He actually told it on the Joe Rogan podcast last year. Vince McMahon was expanding. He wanted to take over that territory in Kansas, the Central States territory that Harley owned a piece of. This did not go over very well with Harley Race, because he wants to know, why is he invading his territory here? And so they're promoting Hogan as the real world champion for an event that they're bringing to Kemper Arena in Kansas City. Kemper Arena is the same arena where Owen Hart died. As Hogan tells the story, and those are some dangerous words, any sentence that starts with Hulk Hogan says, you already know it might be a doozy. But there probably is some truth to what he says here. But as Hogan tells it, he shows up that afternoon of the show, and somebody tells him Harley Race is here and he's got a gun. He tried to light the ring on fire, right? This is what Hogan says he was told. And he's also told that if Harley said that if he finds Hogan, he's going to kill him. Hogan's version of this is hilarious. I want to believe so badly that it's true. He claims his stomach was bothering him that day. I could just picture him doubled over like, oh, brother. I gotta find the toilet, brother. So he's in the bathroom at the arena when suddenly Davey Boy Smith walks in and he says, oh my God, Harley, I can't do the accent, but like, oh my God, Harley's here. He's going to kill you, Hogan. Hogan says he couldn't pull his yellow tights up fast enough. He didn't even wipe his ass. He got the hell out of there because he knew he had no chance, especially if the man had a gun. Now, Hogan was physically bigger than Harley Race, especially at that point. He was younger, he was bigger, but he would be no match for a gun. Even though the head of Paramount, or whatever studio it was, wanted Hogan to be the next John Wayne, if he is to be believed. Now, would John Wayne run from a gunfight? Probably not. Hogan says he turned the corner as he's leaving the bathroom, and there's Harley Race with a gun right in his face. And Harley tells him, I should kill you for doing this to me. And then he puts the gun down, and he says, but I really need a job. Now, Harley's version is that there was no gun. He walked into the locker room, he found Hogan, he gave him an open hand slap, not to the face, but to the rib cage. And when Hogan turned around and saw who it was, he fell back at his chair. In the episode, they said that Harley actually did light the ring on fire that night. Where the truth lies is somewhere in the middle. I feel like we're getting bits and pieces of the actual story here, but I so badly want that Hogan story to be true. Hogan, though, he may have helped Harley get a job in the company, because Harley eventually did come to work for Vince. This was in 86, and they brought Harley in, and he was doing the King of Wrestling gimmick, which I'm sure was goofy to a lot of... I mean, it is goofy. I mean, he's got the robe and the scepter and the crown. I mean, it's goofy. Especially for a guy who, you know, a lot of fans grew up watching Harley Race. He's the tough guy, you know, no-nonsense NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. But as someone who became a fan after that, I only knew of Harley Race as the King, you know, managed by Bobby the Brain Heenan. When he came in, he won the King of the Ring tournament. This was when the King of the Ring was still a house show gimmick. It was not a pay-per-view yet. He got a robe, he got a scepter. His opponents would have to kiss his feet after the matches, you know, kiss my royal feet. One of my earliest childhood memories involves King Harley Race. It was the 1987 Slammy Awards. And there was a giant brawl involving Harley Race and Hacksaw Jim Duggan. It is still one of the craziest things that I have ever seen. They brawl off stage because it's a live ceremony. It's like if you were watching the Oscars, it's in this big auditorium. Okay, this is where the 1987 Slammies are being held. They brawl off stage. And I'm sure everything that followed, I have to assume most of this was pre-taped, until they eventually brawled back out in front of the live crowd at the very end. But you had Gorilla Monsoon. He rushes off stage to go see what's going on. Now he's in the back and he's got his microphone. He's off to the side providing running commentary as these two are fighting. There's live farm animals for whatever reason back there. Chickens in cages. The cages are being opened up. Feathers are flying everywhere. Harley, in a shoot interview that he did, said that they filmed one scene that did not air on TV where he claims they wanted him to kill one of the chickens. So he grabbed one of the chickens and ripped its head off, and blood was splattering all over the place. I don't know how true that is, but he did grab one of the chickens, I think by the neck, and he started flinging it around. He was beating on Duggan with it, using it as a weapon. It was horrible. And apparently the chicken died. Duggan has told that story. It got them a lot of heat with NBC. Harley ended up with powder all over his face, and you know, he had the curly hair, so he looked like a clown. This is my earliest memory of Harley Race. The former 8-time NWA world champion, one of the toughest men in the business, looking like a clown, brawling through women's dressing rooms in the back and flinging chickens around. This was Vince McMahon's vision of wrestling in the 1980s. They talked about the bump that he took onto a table outside the ring during his match with Hulk Hogan on Saturday night's main event, and they had footage of it. What happened is, I mean, if you go back and watch the match and you watch the bump, I mean, especially compared to a lot of these table bumps you see today, this is nothing. Like, it looks like nothing. Hogan is laid out on a table outside the ring. I said Harley was one of the earliest ones doing table bumps in his matches. Hogan is laid out across a table. Harley gets up on the apron and he goes through the table. He very slowly, like, his body goes limp and he falls forward, but Hogan moves out of the way. And Harley goes through the table stomach first. It's a pretty straightforward bump, except that the table didn't fully break. I don't remember if it broke at all, actually. But it didn't fully break, and he blew out his small intestines. And his son found him later that night, I guess, on the floor of his apartment in the fetal position. He thought he was dead. And he ended up with an abdominal hernia. It required multiple surgeries. That ended his WWF career. I don't remember him ever coming back after that. He did eventually wrestle again, but he was never the same. And he was getting older at that point. His body had been through so many accidents and injuries. You know, the leg thing from many years earlier. So he was just a physical wreck anyway. There was a terrible boating accident that his ex-wife talked about. He was drinking scotch. He left the house very angry. I think they had a fight. He took his boat out at night. He ended up plowing into another boat that had all of its lights off. A lot of people in the other boat and Harley, they all got injured. The police came. He resisted arrest while drunk, which is never a good thing to do. So what did his wife do? His wife called Harley's psychiatrist. So this is the first that we're hearing that Harley was seeing a shrink. And the doctor advised her, leave immediately. And she did. And she filed for divorce the next day and filed a restraining order against him. Harley had supposedly told her previously if she ever left him that he would get rid of her. She said it was rough, you know, being with him. And she knows that she should have told somebody about it, but she never did. You know, she was scared or, you know, it only happened once or twice and, you know, he didn't mean it. You know, a lot of the excuses that you probably hear in situations like this. But they had a horrible divorce, and his son would read all about it in the papers because Harley was such a well-known figure in town. One woman who was injured in the boating accident ended up with two broken legs, wanted $10 million. The judge ruled that Harley had to pay $250,000 because he was drunk, and that put him in financial ruin and led to him joining WCW as a manager. And his pairing with Big Van Vader in WCW was perfect. And that was peak Vader, you know, during that WCW run, his feud with Sting, Foley. Mick loved having Harley there during his feud with Vader. He said it was great. They didn't mention this, but his WCW run came to an end after another car accident. He was driving across a bridge when he hit a pothole, popped his airbag, he lost control of the car, he slammed into a concrete barrier. And that pushed the engine block into the front seat. It almost crushed his legs. They covered the Secrets of Wrestling special. Remember that? Aired on NBC back in 1998. It was like Wrestling Secrets Exposed. And it was completely... It was completely antithetical to what Harley Race stood for, but he did. They had him in a mask. They were kind of concealing his identity. You could tell who it was. You know, just the silhouette and the voice. It was pretty obvious it was Harley Race. And there he is on national television exposing the secrets. It's like a magician going on television and giving away all the magic tricks. Completely antithetical to what this man stood for, but he needed the money. He did it for the money. It talked about stomping your feet in matches and why that's done, and blading and salt in the eyes, which is really just baby powder. The stunt granny scene is classic. That was the best part of the whole thing. You got to make money, I guess. But it was Harley Race. You know, if it was anybody else, somebody might have done something to him. But who the fuck was going to mess with Harley Race? What were they going to do to him? What are they going to do to him that hasn't already been done to him? One of the few men he was to be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame and the WCW Hall of Fame, which did not last very long. One of the more legendary names in the industry for sure. And I will share one more story with you. I told this one years ago, but it's worth telling again. Whenever WWE would come to Kansas City for a Monday Night Raw taping or a SmackDown taping, Harley would invite the boys over to his house for a barbecue. And one thing he was famous for was his chili. Owen Hart was the king of ribs. And I'm not talking about food. Mark Henry talked to me. I just interviewed Mark Henry, right, the week and a half ago. And we talked about Owen. And he talked about some of the pranks that Owen would pull on him when they were on the road together. There's a hot sauce called Insanity. Owen happened to have 3 bottles of it on him when he came to Harley's house. And when nobody was looking, he poured all 3 bottles into this big old pot of chili. Long story short, Harley ended up chasing after Owen and sticking him with a cattle prod for messing with his chili. The moral of the story is, don't mess with a man's food. Especially if that man is Harley Race. Those are good words to live by. The most recent Dark Side of the Ring episode tackled the life and career of Chris Colt. And if you are wondering, who the hell is Chris Colt? You were not alone, because I was asking that same question. I knew nothing about the man coming into this episode. So I enjoyed hearing about somebody I did not know anything about, as opposed to running through the same stories I've already heard a million times before for the people I do. One of the cool things about the episode was their use of excerpts from his unpublished memoir. He never finished it, but these were his actual writings. And so throughout the episode, they would have someone narrating some of the passages, which added a good amount of context to the story in the man's own words. Again, Jim Cornette, he was the wise man of the episode. He called Colt the best wrestler that nobody saw. He was a gay wrestler in an era where it still was not accepted. He was also strung out of his mind most of the time. They told a story of a steel cage match that he was booked in where he had taken LSD. I guess he took a hit of it before coming out to the ring. Once he was inside the cage, he started hallucinating and seeing giant spiders climbing into the cage after him, and he completely freaked out. I did too, watching this reenactment they did with the giant spiders. I don't know where they found them, but this was terrifying. So he climbs out of the cage, and he starts punching people, thinking that they're giant spiders too. Drugs are bad, people. Very bad. One wrestler who knew him back then said that Chris used to say, "I can't work if I'm not high." He tried to work sober, he just couldn't do it. He had to be high. He never stayed in any one place for any length of time, so he was somebody who bounced around a lot of different territories in the 70s and in the 80s. Interesting little trivia note, he was Magnum TA's opponent in Magnum's very first wrestling match. So he idolized Janis Joplin, who was a rock star of her era. She died of a drug overdose when she was only 27 years old. He would tell people, "I plan to be dead at 27 just like Janis Joplin." He ended up living to 49. Still young, but not as young as he wanted to. The way he lived his life, it's amazing he didn't end up dead a lot sooner than that. In his writings, he admitted to having feelings for both men and women, but he was more attracted to men. He badly wanted to become a pro wrestler. He prostituted himself in the streets to make money. He ended up in a tag team with a wrestler named Ron Dupree, who also became his lover. They had to keep their relationship hush-hush because otherwise it would make it harder for them to find work if people knew they were more than just tag team partners. After Ron was forced into retirement due to a heart attack, Colt had to find a new tag team partner. Enter Bill Anderson, who was interviewed for this. As crazy as the LSD spider story was, there was another story where Chris, Bill, and a wrestler by the name of Mike Boyette, they became a trio, and they were on the road in the car traveling one night. Chris was getting high in the backseat, what else is new, and he randomly punches Bill, who's driving the car. He punches him in the back of the head, and he starts fighting with Mike, he's fighting with Bill, probably, again, drugged out of his mind. Well, Mike Boyette was no one to mess around with. He was a Vietnam vet. He had a judo background. He was a world judo champion. Chris gets out of the car, and he is still being very aggressive. He takes a shot at Mike, who ends up dropping him with a front face lock. He puts him out. Let's go. It's like the Richard Belzer thing, right? Or what Punk tried to do to Jack Perry. Chris's body falls limp. He falls down to the pavement. This is in the middle of the road, somewhere, in the middle of the night. He's out cold. He tells Bill, get back in the car. Mike gets in the car with him, and he tells Bill, back the car up. He's like, why? Just back the car up. So he backs the car up, and what he wants him to do, he wants him to run this fucking guy over. He takes his foot, Mike does, puts it over Chris's foot, or rather Bill's foot, on the gas pedal, because he wants him to run this man over and kill him. He is determined to kill Chris Colt and put an end to this once and for all. And he would have, had Bill not swerved at the very last second to avoid turning Chris into roadkill. And then Mike was like, just get out of here. So they left him. They left him in the middle of the road and they drove off. Chris's lover, Ron Dupree, eventually he dies of a heart attack. He was doing ring announcing at a small show somewhere. And he died in Chris's arms, and Chris was never the same after that. He changed his gimmick from Chris Colt to the Chris Colt Experience. Maybe that's where Cornette got it from. And he starts acting even more bizarre, coming out to Alice Cooper's Welcome to My Nightmare. Cornette claims that Colt invented modern entrance music in pro wrestling. So was it Chris Colt, or was it the Freebirds? I feel like I've heard Cornette and other people credit multiple people for ushering in the era of theme music in pro wrestling. Apparently now it's Chris Colt who ushered it in. So then later on, he adopted a Nazi gimmick. He became Chris Von Colt. You know, in the 50s, coming out of World War II, Nazis were... they were all the rage in pro wrestling as heels. But this wasn't the 1950s. This wasn't the 1960s. This wasn't the 1970s. This was the 80s. So he was just being an asshole. And his drug addictions, they spiraled out of control. He goes from cocaine, now he's on crystal meth. His career is over by the late 80s. He just disappears off the face of the earth. Nobody knew where he was. Until someone happened to be watching an adult film that he was in. He had gotten into gay porn, and he had filmed a couple of movies. I mean, it wasn't like a career. I think he did two films for this one director. And we got some snippets of the stuff that he did, not that stuff, but there were some snippets from the films, just promos that he was apparently cutting in the films. There was one part where he's lifting weights. I will say I actually laughed out loud at this. He's lifting weights, cutting a promo, and he says, another victory. One more time, someone goes down, and they're going to go down on me. I started cracking up. That was... I was not expecting that. So they actually found the director of the films that he did, and they interviewed him for the episode. Now, this guy has a PhD. He's worked as a university professor teaching film and literature. He's written something like 20 books. And they found this guy, and he said back then, Hulk Hogan was like a god in the gay community. And when the WWF would run shows at the Cow Palace in San Francisco, you would have tons of gay men there rooting him on. Rooting for Hulkamania. And here I thought the kids were his biggest demographic. Little did I know. But there isn't much else to the story after this. That's kind of the nuts and bolts and the interesting stuff that I took out of it. You know, Chris passed away in 1995. He was found, according to his niece, in a back alley somewhere in Seattle. How he got there, she doesn't know. Someone else says he was found with a needle in his arm. His death certificate listed HIV as a factor in his death, although there was no autopsy performed. And Jim Cornette says that he was ahead of his time and he brought rock into wrestling long before Hulk Hogan and Cyndi Lauper did. Lanny Poffo actually tagged with Chris back in 1976. And Lanny Poffo once called him the greatest wrestler that never made it. One of the Moondogs, Ed Moretti, was another tag team partner of Chris's. Also happens to be Nick Wayne's grandfather. He said that Chris was one of the greatest workers he's ever seen. He would rank him up there with Ray Stevens and Pat Patterson. I'm glad I know more about who he is, because I came into this not knowing anything about him. The story is pretty thin, because there just wasn't a whole lot to his career, but I think it fits the bill for what Dark Side of the Ring is supposed to be, and I can appreciate an episode here and there on a subject that hasn't already been beaten to death 1,000 times. Let's take some mailbag questions from you guys. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. I plucked a few out here, so let's start with Tommy from St. Louis. I was thinking about this Us teaser on WWE television. I have seen people discuss Bo Dallas and Alexa Bliss, but what if it relates to a new idea for the already trademarked Wyatt Six? What if they brought the Wyatt Six to life with Bo, Alexa, Braun Strowman, Eric Rowan, Nikki Cross, and Dexter Lumis? All the creeps together in a new cult paying homage to the original. I just think it would be great. A versatile way to shake things up and give talent something to honor Bray with. I think that would be a fine idea. I think you may be onto something. I did see something before I started recording here. Apparently, East Coast Pro Wrestling announced today that they had to cancel an appearance by Eric Rowan due to new contractual obligations. Could mean nothing, but I also think that your idea sounds very plausible to me. So, because it's pretty clear we're getting Uncle Howdy and Alexa are coming back together in some way. There was another glitch on SmackDown Friday night with a message. You know, you forgot about us. But the Wyatt Six is something that was rumored for a long time when Bray first came back. And they did, I think they did trademark it. And then we never got a chance to see how that might play out. So a Wyatt Six with those people? I mean, Dexter Lumis is somebody I keep forgetting they have under contract. He just disappeared off the face of the earth. Braun Strowman, he's nearing a return. He still hasn't been medically cleared. I think it's still probably early for somebody who had a neck fusion. He posted something the other day, talked about how he's getting ready to come back soon. I don't even think it's been a full year yet. So his return may still be a little ways off. But yeah, a Wyatt Six and now this news about Rowan, it's certainly possible. George from London, England. Interested to know your thoughts on who do you think will be a bigger star between Jade Cargill and Tiffany Stratton. I remember watching Shayna Baszler and Bianca Belair on NXT, and Shayna was a beast. But when Shayna and Bianca went onto the main roster, Bianca is the one who thrived. So between Tiffany and Jade, who do you think will have the more successful career? I think that Tiffany Stratton is going to be more successful in the wrestling ring. I think that she's going to have the more successful wrestling career. I think Jade Cargill will have the more successful career overall, because I think her future is in television and movies outside of wrestling. So whatever she does in wrestling, it will not be nearly as big as what I think she will go on to do outside of wrestling. Tiffany is just more of a natural in the ring than Jade is. So I think that she'll have more titles and more success in the ring. But Jade is, I mean, Jade just has superstar written all over. Brian from Michigan. With Matt Hardy now being a free agent, buy or sell on which tag team run ended up being a bigger waste of time? The Hardys in AEW or the Dudleys in WWE in 2015 and 2016? The Hardys in AEW. Because they would have won the tag team titles had it not been for Jeff getting into trouble again. I mean, that sabotaged their entire run. The Dudleys were basically used as enhancement talent from what I remember from that run. But I do remember them getting some title matches out of it on pay-per-view. I remember them wrestling the New Day. They may have been involved in some other pay-per-view matches. That's more than I can say for the Hardys. so I'll say the Hardys in AEW. Kevin from Sycamore, Illinois. What is the possibility of giving R-Truth a title run sometime this year, even briefly, as a thank you for the loyalty he has given the company for all these years? No, he shouldn't. He's already got the tag team title. That's enough. The World Heavyweight title is not a lifetime achievement award. That's what a Hall of Fame ring is for. Jesus from Connecticut. My cousin asked me this question, and I'm not sure what my answer is yet, because I have to put some thought into it, but I think it's a good question to ask you. Do you prefer tag teams that look and wrestle similar, like the Hardys, the Young Bucks, the Usos, or the more odd couple pairings with guys that don't look much alike and wrestle differently, like the Hart Foundation, the Outsiders, and the New Age Outlaws? That's actually a very thoughtful question. And I thought about it, and I think it's a mix of both. But definitely, me personally, I lean towards the odd couple pairings. I love the Hart Foundation, Brett and the Anvil, two very different workers. I love the Steiner brothers. Scott would do more crazy moves than Rick would. You know, they complemented each other very well. Harlem Heat was kind of like that. Booker was the flashier worker of the two. Owen Hart and the British Bulldog, they were a very underrated tag team. You don't hear people talking about too many classic matches they had, but they were a great team. You know, Bulldog was more of a power wrestler of the two. Owen was more of the finesse. The Rock and Saw Connection, very entertaining, right? You can't find two more different personalities than Rock and Mankind. So that is what I tend to gravitate towards. I like the odd couple pairings better. DJ from Cleveland, Ohio. One of the things I like about the UFC Hall of Fame is that they induct actual fights. If WWE would induct actual matches into their Hall of Fame, what five matches would you like to see honored? As long as they don't give out rings for it, because, you know, Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart, I mean, they would end up with so many, they would have to make earrings and ankle bracelets because they're going to run out of fingers. Five matches that would go in, like the first five, I think the first WrestleMania main event is an obvious one. Hogan versus Andre, WrestleMania 3 has to be in there. Savage against Steamboat at WrestleMania 3 has to be in there. I would say the ladder match at WrestleMania 10 with Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon because of how influential that was. And to throw one a little bit later in there, I think the submission match from WrestleMania 13 with Bret Hart and Steve Austin. I'd say that would be a good place to start. And David from Sacramento. David is a big Be the Booker fan. We do our little Be the Booker segment that I started years ago on the YouTube streams, and he has taken notes and he has collected the names of a lot of the matches that I have booked. He says, with WrestleMania in the books and it being two nights, I ran a poll for a very special Solo Monster supercard. The polls below were all the matches from February and March in Be the Booker. That's 83 matches to choose from. After the group's participation, the Facebook group, with over 100 votes, these are the top 14 matches to make up night one and night two. Buy or sell on which night you think is the stronger of the two cards. So I appreciate the effort that you put into this, by the way. Night one, now these are all matches that I randomly booked on YouTube. Night one, a buried alive match. Oh, this was great. A buried alive match with the immortal Hulk Hogan against Hollywood Hulk Hogan. The big question there, I love the buried alive stip too. The thing I love about this match is who goes over if they each play their creative control card? I don't know. We haven't been able to figure that out. Konosuke Takeshita against Sheamus. I mean, that'd be a hell of a match. Bianca Belair against Gail Kim. Bret Hart and Bill Goldberg against the Spirit Squad. Drew McIntyre against Mankind. On a pole match, bro. Or on a pole, bro match. I think my eyeballs are crossed up here. The American Nightmare, Cody Rhodes, with a torn pec, against the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. And Proud and Powerful, that's Santana and Ortiz against DIY. So that's night one of a Solo Monster supercard. Night 2, Vader So we're talking 1992 Vader against 2014 Brock Lesnar, CM Punk against Kenny Omega, a dog collar match between the Briscoes and the Midnight Express, the Steiner Brothers against the Hart Foundation, which did happen once, Perk Angle against Sabu, main event Jey Uso against Ilya Dragunov, and Hikaru Shida against Kairi Sane. I don't even think it's close. I mean, night two blows away night one. I mean, just for Vader and Lesnar alone, Vader and Lesnar, Punk and Omega, Steiners and the Hearts. I mean, come on. Night two, it's not even close. But David, thank you for that, man. That was fun. Thank you for putting the effort into that. Thank you guys for tuning in this week, as I know you do every week. 857 of these in the book, with number 858 coming up next Sunday. Do go ahead and take advantage of that BetterHelp offer, though. I have gotten feedback from people who have really gotten something out of it, and it's cool to hear that. So again, the link is betterhelp.com/solomonster. That'll get you the offer, and you can give it a try if it's something you've been thinking about. So go ahead and support that way. Follow me on Twitter, X, I guess it would be, @solomonster. We got Raw, we got SmackDown, we got Dynamite all coming up this week. This will be the final Dynamite before Dynasty. And I will be back with you again for more Sound Off next Sunday. Again, thank you for getting me to 79,000 subs on YouTube. Let's see if we can hit 80K in the next few weeks. Be well, stay safe, and I will see you back here next Sunday for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonsters Sounds Off.
Kareem points out, we celebrated the fact that we just had our first full week, all bells and be the booker, but we have a pay-per-view. I may have celebrated a little too soon. The Green Pianist says, Kareem is the kid in class that reminds the teacher about homework.
Teacher, you forgot to give us homework. We need homework. You have one more be the booker. Don't forget, one more.
I say tomorrow we hang Kareem upside down and shake him so his lunch money falls out of his pocket. And then we'll throw him in his locker and we'll lock him in there. How about that?
Teacher.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster Sounds Off.